Welcome to Sharkpedia. We're your hosts, Megan
and Imani,
a couple of shark researchers that want to bring the science to you.
We're creating a space to learn all things sharks
and their relatives,
answer your questions,
and learn from the legends in the field.
Get ready to jump in.
Let's dive deep into the world of sharks.
Hello, sharkies. Welcome back to Sharkpedia. This is Imani.
And Megan.
And we are so excited for this episode. We have Dr. Mark Royer here today to talk with us about scalloped hammerheads. Dr. Royer, would you please introduce yourself to our audience?
Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. This is Dr. Mark Royer, and I am 1 year out of completing my PhD. I was over at the University of Hawaii in Manoa under Dr. Kim Holland and Dr. Carl Meyer. And this is all work that was not a direct part of my thesis, but it was more of a side project that developed while I was conducting my thesis work.
Oh, that's really cool. Yeah, how is the post-graduate life?
Asking as current grad students.
Yes. Well, post-graduate life during the COVID era certainly has its challenges.
Yeah.
So it was... I was able to navigate and finish up my PhD in the best way that I could. And I was, of course, doing defense and everything over Zoom, which worked out really well. It was nice to have that reach of an audience, so that way people, you know, it's hard for people to come to Hawaii if they're not there. So that way people could tune in, whether they're all the way, like my brother in Scotland, or my family all the way over in Maryland. So it was very nice to have that opportunity.
Yeah, that's so awesome.
And since then, it's been going into the field of applying for postdocs.
Fun.
On to the next challenge.
Yeah. I actually really like the Zoom defenses because I've been able to watch so many of my friends' defenses and see what it actually looks like when you just do the presentation part, and then they move obviously to the private part with their committee. But I kind of hope that they keep that so that when I defend in 5 years, I can have all my family watch and my friends watch. That just sounds like it would be just amazing to have such a large reach in comparison to what you'd normally have.
Yeah. One of the best parts was the teachers who wrote my letters of recommendation back in high school were able to tune in to hear it, which they wouldn't have otherwise done that if it was just in person. So that was kind of one of the silver linings to this whole, this was back in May. So this was still when things were drastically shifting. All of a sudden, so it was kind of a silver lining to that development.
Yeah, and how cool for your teachers to be able to see you at pretty much the very end of your schooling. That's awesome. That's really cool to see you from start to finish.
Yeah.
That's so awesome. Yeah, I definitely know some friends that were able, even before the pandemic, that just hosted up Zoom, and I had only used Zoom one time before the pandemic, and it was for defense. So it's definitely, I want to keep it going too, because I think it's awesome to be able to just jump in and see all these people and what they've accomplished if you can't travel there. It's great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely. So as per usual, Megan is going to read the summary for this article that we're going to be talking about, and then we are going to dive into it. I am super excited to talk about this paper.
I am equally super excited to talk about this paper. So this paper that we talked about, or we've read for this podcast today, is titled Scalloped Hammerhead Sharks Swim on Their Side with Dial Shifts in Roll Magnitude and Periodicity. The authors were Dr. Mark Royer et al., and it was just published last year. So the summary of this article is as follows. In a previous study by Payne et al. In 2016, they found that great hammerhead sharks will swim on their sides up to 90% of their swimming time at between a 50 and 75 degree angle. A wind tunnel experiment with a shark model demonstrated that the side swimming can actually reduce drag by up to 10% compared to when they're swimming upright. Scalloped hammerhead sharks have a similar body plan with a longer dorsal fin than the length of the pectoral fins. Therefore, Dr. Royal and his colleagues set out to see if scalloped hammerheads did a similar side-swimming behavior to reduce that drag. Now, they did some really cool stuff that I'm so excited to ask about to test this theory. They used something called a triaxial accelerometer tag, and they combined this with a depth and temperature archiving tag, and they housed it in a foam float that was rated up to 2,000 meters deep. I already have so many questions about all of this. And then they equipped it with a time release so that at a certain time period, a whole contraption would pop off the animal and come back up to the surface so they could recover those tags and download all the information. And not only that, but they tagged the animals with a video logger. This is so much equipment, and that's so cool. It's so much information that you gathered. And what you inevitably found was that scalloped hammerheads did exhibit that side swimming behavior as well. They have a larger dorsal fin to pectoral fin height, and it was actually larger than the great hammerheads. So they spent about 48% of their time swimming during the day and 82% of their time side swimming at night. So I found that really interesting, and they also had a very clear change in behavior from how they swam during the day than they did at night, which was very distinct at that sunrise sunset. So yeah, let's jump into this. This was so cool. There was so much information that you got from a lot of really cool tags. So let's just kind of start there, since we talked about kind of a lot of equipment and some of our listeners might not be familiar with these archival tags or an accelerometer tag. So Dr. Royer, do you mind just starting with what these tags exactly were and how did you combine them all onto the animal to get the information that you needed?
Sure thing. This was kind of a new field that's developing in this area of shark researchers, general megafauna research in the aquatic realm, where that's where we're taking all these different sensors and combining them all into one to get some really high resolution data on just almost everything that you possibly could on your animal. In this case, it was the scalloped hammerhead. And actually not mentioned in this paper because it wasn't relevant to this study, but that was also included in that was also there was a temperature probe that was going into the shark's muscle to measure their body temperature. So on top of all those things, we had temperature probes as well. Some tags even had impellers to measure swimming speed. Some had magnetometers. So this
What's a magnetometer?
A magnetometer is kind of like just like how there's a triaxial accelerometer. A triaxial magnetometer measures the magnetic magnitude in the X, Y, and Z direction. So that can be used to everything from the shark's, or there's another way of getting the shark's orientation, but it also tell you what their compass heading is as well too.
That is so amazing.
It is a treasure trove of data that I can probably pump out papers for until I retire at the age of 90.
That's amazing.
But that's because this project, I did this during my PhD studies, but this wasn't actually a chapter in my PhD. This was a side project that suddenly developed while I was focusing on something else. The main purpose of why I developed these tag packages, that's commonly what they're referred to as in the literature, where you combine all these sensors into one package and attach it to the animal. What I was hoping to study was another unique behavior that I can talk about, and this will have to be like another episode because there's so much to talk about, was this deep diving behavior that scalloped hammerheads do, where at night they behave kind of like a short fin pilot whale or a beaked whale, where they dive down hundreds and hundreds of meters to forage on deep prey. And they spike down, shoot up to the surface. That study hasn't been published yet, so maybe we can save it until then.
Oh yeah,
but
we're talking about that.
yeah. So we knew that they did this because from previous tagging studies that our lab did, where we used mini pats, which are those pop up archival tags, or those like those little bulbous tags you can attach on the outside of a shark. They record depth and temperature and light levels to get geolocation. They'll eventually pop up and they'll tell you what depths and what temperatures the shark experienced. And we learned from those tags in that this was a lot of tagging work that was done by the older graduate students when I arrived in this lab. And we found that scalloped hammerheads off Hawaii do these deep dives down to 800 meters. I wanted to examine what their swimming activity is like and how they're regulating their body temperature when they go into such cold water. Hmm. And so it was after I got my first tag package deployed on a scalloped hammerhead, which it took me years to learn how to routinely catch these animals and how to and how to put these tags on them as well too. So for you younger graduate students out there, I know there, it might seem like a lot of pressure to try to get your graduate studies done in a short amount of time. Just the nature of this work does require a long work. So I started my PhD or my graduate work in 2011, and I didn't finish until last year because it took so long to basically learn how to do this properly and safely, both for the people on board and also for the animal as well too, because scalloped hammerheads are very fragile animals and kind of elusive as well. So anyway, it wasn't until I got my first tag package out on a scalloped hammerhead that paper from Nick Payne et al. Came out that showed that great hammerhead's role. And I thought that was absolutely fascinating. So as soon as I got that data back from that first hammerhead, I immediately looked at the accelerometer data, which could tell you what the shark's body orientation was. And sure enough, I could see that signal where the shark is clearly swimming on its side for extended periods of time. So from every successive tag package that I put on these hammerheads for my PhD work, I'd also use that data to analyze this rolling behavior as well. So that's kind of the neat thing with this new era of combining multiple sensors in these tag packages and getting high resolution data, is that there is so much you can do with them, so much like that can't be fit into a single paper. It's like each requires its own dedicated analysis for.
I mean, that's kind of amazing too, though, especially if you have limited funds, you can really allocate those funds on a few distinct animals and get, like you said, a lot of information out of them, which is really
exactly awesome. I would consider this to be a high risk, high reward. And part of what you mentioned there is that the foam I was using is rated to 2000 meters. And so what was nice about this project and something that you'll find throughout your graduate careers is funding is hard to come across, especially these days.
Yes.
That's another casualty of the COVID era where funding sources have sometimes dried up a bit. You have to be creative with the tools that are given to you, and just doing field work alone, that by itself requires a lot of money. And sometimes you have to rely on the support and infrastructure of where your institute is. And luckily enough, our lab at Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology had a lot of logistical support to do this project. But also too, it's making connections and getting creative with other materials, so that foam that I used to integrate all those separate instruments into, that was actually leftover foam that was cut off when they were used on the University of Hawaii's deep submersibles that the Oceanography Department uses to do their deep sea research.
Oh, cool.
So around the submarine, they have to use that syntactic foam as ballast, and any parts that cut off are useless for them, but that foam is very expensive as well. But I don't need something the size of a dinner table. I just need something the size of a brick.
Yeah.
And so they said, you know, we have these boxes of cut pieces of foam that aren't any use to us. Go in there and help yourself.
Here's some foam.
If I had to buy that foam myself, I would have to have paid $400 per square foot of it.
Man.
So it's things like that where it's good to, look within your community and form connections, and things like that can make all the difference in the world of being able to conduct the research that you want to. And as for the some of those other instruments on there, like the temperature and the depth recorders, were left over from a previous study that my advisor did on big eye tuna, where they were measuring their body temperature. Those were wildlife computer Mark 9 tags that have a stalk. So that's how I was able to measure the body temperature. And so those, instead of putting them into a tuna, I just put them onto my tag package. And then the funding, I was able to use those to buy the expensive accelerometers, as well as the satellite tags from wildlife computers that I could put on there to make sure I can find that tag package when it pops off again.
Yeah.
It would send off as when those tags pop off, they would send off a satellite signal. I could get a notification for that, and then it would give off a VHF beep that I could zero in on and retrieve it. And so things like that, like using leftover tools, leftover instruments, really helped cut costs down and got the job done. And so there are some times where you can buy these packages pre-assembled, but that costs a lot of money, which is money I did not have at hand at the time. So basically I took all these things together, And then I would just go into my lab late at night, and I don't think anyone knows this, but I'll tell everyone now, I would like blare the Iron Man soundtrack.
Yeah.
And just like start getting creative and just start assembling these things until eventually I like came out with these tag packages that would basically act as like a flight recorder for a shark.
Yeah.
Oh man.
So when you mentioned how they pop off, and basically like for our readers who don't know what this means, the whole package, right, would float to the surface basically, and you'd have to actually go physically get it, right?
Yes. So there's those of you who have done shark tagging or just any type of tagging for fish or any large animals. You know, tagging is a very generic term in that there's many different types of tags that use it for many different functions. These particular tags, they do not transmit a location unless it's at the surface, but these are attached to the animal and it was not fixed in a way. It wasn't like on the dorsal fin. The antenna wasn't on the dorsal fin, so it would let me know when it was at the surface. I wouldn't know where it was until it popped off. But yes, and because the accelerometer will record at 16 or 32 hertz per sec, so that's 16 or 32 readings for both the X and the Y and the Z axis. Per second, that's a lot of data, so that you can't transmit all that. That's way too much. You have to physically get that data back in hand. So in order to do that, you have to physically take that instrument, that sensor that logs all that data, and get it back to you and plug it into your computer to get all those millions of data points back. So these tag packages are set up in a way where it's kind of like how those pop-up archival tags come up to the surface. Those are meant to transmit data, but it's at a much lower resolution. Whereas these ones, when they pop up to the surface, there's a little miniature version of a fin mount tag attached to that tag package that would transmit its location. And that's the other challenge right there, is that, we put so much investment in this tag package. It takes a lot of work to get these on a shark, but you're not done. It's almost like, kind of like an Apollo or a Mercury mission where everything has to go right to the final step, where you can send a person into space and into orbit. If they don't come back to Earth to safe and sound, then the whole thing's a failure. Just like how you can go through all the work of putting this tag on a shark, it can get all that data, but if you don't get that tag back in your hand and if it doesn't download data, then all that effort was for nothing. And also, if you don't get that tag back, then everything attached to it, which costs a lot of money, is gone.
It's just floating around the ocean somewhere.
Exactly. So it took a lot. So that took a lot of grit as well, where it took a lot of strategic planning. Is planning too. So the other nice thing was that by cutting costs, as I was saying earlier, how was I able to cut costs for designing these tag packages? I could use that money to help pay boat operators to take me on their boat at a last minute notice to go find these things around the Hawaiian Islands. There's a lot of ocean around here and not much land, so there's a very high possibility for something to just go floating off and it will go into the Pacific Gyre, or maybe it'll land on the shores of Japan 50 years from now.
Oh my gosh.
I don't have time to wait for that. So
needle like, in a haystack.
in the currents are really ripped. So thanks to a friend and colleague of ours, Jeff Muir, who was a technician in our lab. When these things popped up, thankfully they're all around Oahu, which that was kind of lucky, because these sharks can migrate. They can move long distances in a short period of time.
Did you get all of them back?
I did, actually. I got all of them back.
That is amazing. Are you kidding?
Like, almost all of them popped up like outside of our bay. Some of them popped up on the opposite side of the island. So we would have to meet up at like 3 o'clock in the morning, drive a boat for hours on end. And like when you deploy these things, we deploy them in calm water, because we don't want to be in heavy waves when we're tagging these animals, but you can't predict what the sea conditions will be 7, 20, 25 days out into the future. So you just kind of roll the dice, and sometimes we'd have to go out into 8-foot seas at 3 o'clock in the morning and
grab
these things. And luckily he was a commercial fisherman, and he's used to those kinds of things. So we would thankfully go grab these things and you have to grab them within that day, because otherwise they'll get too far away and you'll need something like a NOAA ship to go search for them. But obviously I couldn't do that.
So speaking of the length of time, right, for each of these tag attachments. How did you decide how long the, like, whole tag package was going to stay on the species? And, like, why did you choose the specific variables that you did?
That's a good question. So the tag interval, so if you, for those of you who have read the paper, you'll see that the durations were, the first one was 7 days, the next one was like 14 days, and the ones after that were 21, or the majority were 23 days. That's because the, as I was saying earlier, the original purpose for doing this tagging was to examine that deep diving behavior for these scalped hammerheads. That was the focus of my PhD. The tricky part was, in order to catch those sharks, I had to wait until they came into Kanehoe Bay. That's on the windward side of Oahu. That's where they're in a shallow area near our lab where we could reliably catch them. They'd do this during their summer migration into the bay, where they would follow the females. The female adults would come in and give birth to their pups. The males would follow suit. So that was our easiest time to catch them. Outside of that, it's very hard to catch a scalloped hammerhead. However, when they're in the bay, they kind of stay around the shallow areas for a little bit. It can be a random time. They can either just stay in there for like a few days, a few weeks, or longer. And so if I wanted to capture that deep diving data, I had to put these tags on these sharks for a extended duration. So it couldn't just be 3 or 5 days, which is kind of like the usual deployment you do for these types of tags. I had to push it out to weeks so I would have that time when, like, they're done doing their work in the shallows, and they would head off for a few days, then they would go offshore and do multiple nights of those deep dives.
Were the 7-day increments just like so you could get something back and see if it was long enough?
Yes, that, because that 7-day one, that was the first one I've ever put a tag package out on a scalloped hammerhead before. So that was kind of like, that was me kind of like getting braver and braver and testing my luck in this. And that I didn't want to do the first deployment for 23 days because I wanted to make sure that, one, I could get these things done on a scalloped hammerhead, get the data that I need, and get that tag back at a... and reliably get that tag back. Even that first one was quite a journey to get because it popped off. We didn't get a signal from it. We got a weak signal. I had to go all the way to the very tip of Kaena Point on Oahu. So basically, I had to like walk to. My interns and I had to walk across a very dry and hot landscape in the middle of June in Hawaii in the baking sun. Walk to the very tip of the island and point our antenna out and then hear the signal, and we could hear it floating away. So we thought the thing was gone. Thankfully, our colleague Jeff, who I mentioned earlier, got on the phone, got me in touch with a fisherman. Sure enough, 3 o'clock that morning, he says, you know, meet this guy at 2 o'clock in the morning at the Haleiwa Boat Harbor. And we boated for like 10 hours, able to find the thing and get it back. So that was just the first
10 one. Hours?
Oh my God. That, I mean, you just said that so subtly.
Yeah. Do you have like an average time that you had to go out to get each of these receivers that popped off?
We typically had to get them back within 24 hours from when they first popped up to the surface, because anything longer than that, the currents would have taken them too far away from the island.
I mostly mean like from when you like got on the boat to go retrieve them. Like, was 10 hours a normal amount of time that you had to be on the boat?
For the ones that popped off far away, yes. We got lucky, and sometimes some of them would pop off offshore of Kanehoe Bay. That's the Kanehoe Bay is where our institute was located. So that one, that was about like a 3 to 4 hour or 5 hour journey. It could be shorter than that, but they always popped off on like days when we had heavy seas, so we would have to carefully steer the boat like in these heavy waves to make sure we don't capsize or anything like that, while also trying to, you know, wave this antenna around to try to find this thing. And also, it's like as you know, it's like trying to find something in the ocean that's no matter how brightly colored orange it is, when you've got heavy waves, it can be 20 feet in front of you, and if there's a wave in front of you, you're not going to see it. So it takes a lot more added effort in those heavy seas to find these things.
Yeah, you must have gone through a lot of Dramamine.
At those times, because if you're the one, in some cases, if you're the one driving the boat, or like if the fear of, oh my gosh, I'm going to lose my PhD if I don't get this thing back. That's enough to like kind of like psych you out of whatever nausea you would have, no matter how heavy the seas are.
So seasickness for you.
When you've got that much at stake to like get these things back, that's the best relief against any kind of seasickness.
You have more things to worry about.
Exactly. Yes.
I mean, that's what I was going to ask. What was that feeling like when you got those tags back? And then like, how did that feel by the end when you actually got every single one back? Because shark scientists that I've talked to typically say, oh yeah, I lose like a large percentage of my tags.
Yes, it was a major sense of relief to know that I had the sample size that I needed, and not knowing that this was even going to be pulled off. Like I said, this was a very high risk, high reward project. And the best one is the very last one that we retrieved. Actually, that one was not retrieved by boat. That was a tag that was initially lost, and that when it was deployed on a shark, we never heard from it. But that was like my 12th deployment. I thought like, well, that was kind of the icing on the cake. And if it didn't succeed, then, you know, it's a loss, but at least we had what we needed. But that was in, I believe it was 2018 when that tag was deployed, summer of 2018. Exactly 1 year later in 2019, we got a message that a woman, Liana Robinson from Ni'ihau, the furthest island in the main Hawaiian chain, they found that tag a year later on the beach of Ni'ihau, and they're able to, and we have our contact information on there. They're able to get in touch with us and return that tag to us. And that was the one that had the video camera on it, so we could see the footage of what the shark was doing while
it
was swimming.
Lucky.
So yes. So wow. we were very grateful to the Robinson family for their help in that.
Yeah. Whenever you go to the Monterey Bay Aquarium, they always talk about how one of their tags, on like one of the sharks that they tagged, the tag like ended up in the back of someone's like car in their trunk and like was floating around for like a year in someone's trunk, and they were like, this shark is definitely not on land, like it's not driving around going to Safeway. So that's so awesome that she like actually called and was like, hey, I found something of yours.
Yes, it was very nice of them. And in fact, there's a similar story to that in that the first time I ever used one of these tag packages for my own studies, it was actually for my first chapter for my PhD, where I was doing this on a similar study on six-gilled sharks. Those are a big, large deep sea shark, that we have here off Hawaii. And, the first tag that popped off again, the same drama went through where we didn't hear from the tag initially. Eventually it comes up to the surface a day and a half late. It stayed on the shark because that probe measuring temperature in the muscle was pinched in there. And six-gill sharks are rather sluggish, especially compared to a hammerhead, so when they're just kind of slowly swimming around the bottom, that thing stayed with it for an extra time. So when you don't hear from this tag, you're wondering what happened to it. Eventually it popped off. My lab mate James took me on his personal boat to go find it, and seas were rough. It was kind of like a mogul course out there. A lot of us got sick, and when we went to the position where we thought it was, we eventually heard it coming. The next satellite fix was coming from inland of the island. So we had to take the boat all the way back. And then my girlfriend at the time, now wife, we saw this signal coming from the town of Waimanalo on Oahu. So we were like, okay, we know this thing is inland. So it must have been picked up by a fisherman or some boater out there. So we had to go into our car and then drive around Waimanalo with our little headphones on and our little antenna, like pointing at houses, waiting to hear these satellite signals from this tag being given off. And sure enough, we were eventually going door to, we were like knocking on people's doors saying like, hey, have you seen this yellow brick with antennas from it? People were very friendly. And eventually late at night, we eventually came across this house in a cul-de-sac that, or these older men were like out on their driveway, just having a few drinks and have a like celebration of some kind. We walked up to them and asked them if they were out on the water that day and if they had seen some type of motion graphic device that was yellow and had antennas on it, and they just lit up, and one guy's like, yes, yes, I did. He had it in his truck. He got it out, and he was, when we told him that it was attached to a shark, he was ecstatic because he was telling everyone on the, when they were out fishing for a lua or giant trevally that day, and when he picked it up, he had a bet with everyone on the boat. They says like, this was probably some type of shark tag, and no one else believed him. So we were there to validate his.
Yes.
I'm sure he was so happy.
So it's things like that where this type of work will definitely get you in touch with the community. And if for those of you young graduate students who are in the midst of doing some project like this or planning to do some project like this, definitely have some rewards set up for when people do this. And for one, it's going to be a huge relief to you when they find it. Two, it's like one of the best outreach. It's like one of the most like spur of the moment, like spur of the moment outreach moments you can have, where when you tell people like what you're doing, what these tags are for, they are so excited to hear it because now they're a part of it, that they helped recover this this instrument for you that was a part of a shark.
Yeah.
And so have things like we give them some money, and we give them some lab t-shirts as well.
Yeah, it's always good to make those connections with fishing.
Free t-shirts. Absolutely. I'll always take a free t-shirt.
Oh yeah. So that is amazing. I mean, getting that equipment out there is such a feat on its own. And then you got this awesome information about the scalloped hammerhead. So let's talk about that. I personally had never actually heard of this rolling behavior. However, I work, you know, not in tropical places where you see hammerheads. So is that something that you could typically see? Like if you were diving, have you seen that? Did you know that they did that? Side swimming behavior?
I myself, prior to the study, I had not heard of that actually as well either. I feel like for most of the times when people see great hammerheads, usually when I've seen, or like when I've seen photos or footage of great hammerheads, it's usually at that site in Bimini where they're, but that's a provision site. So they're swimming in their bottom, and that's not like their usual. So you're not seeing them just kind of generally cruising. In terms of for scalloped hammerheads, they're kind of, unless you go to the right place in the world, they're kind of elusive or difficult to find sometimes. And the times where I've seen them in the water, it was very fleetingly. However, there were people who have seen them at their aggregations in places like such as the Galapagos, or in the Gulf of California, and in our particular case off the Big Island of Hawaii on the Kona coast, there are these aggregations of female scalloped hammerheads that are seen during the winter time. And some wildlife or underwater photography friends of ours, Darren Verbeck and Corey Foltz, have taken these photographs of these aggregations of hammerheads off the Big Island of Hawaii.
Wow.
And from those photos alone, you can see it's hard to tell because they're in like in the open ocean. So you see around them, there's nothing but blue. So it's hard to see a reference as to which way is immediately up, but just relative to each other, you can see some hammerheads are like at like a 45 or 90 degree angle from each other.
Right.
So regardless of which one's upright, you know that like some of them are swimming at a strange angle. So at least for those who have seen that, they know that they've known that like scalloped hammerheads do sometimes swim at these weird angles. But you know, when a shark kind of leaves our sight, what they do for the rest of the day is kind of a little unknown to us. So it wasn't known just how prevalent this was and how they do it. They actually spend the majority of their time swimming at these strange swimming banked angles.
Yeah. So at this point in my life, I've seen and or helped with around 5 scientific like tagging workups of great hammerheads, and they all do the listing behavior when you release them. So we'll like push them off the platform to push them into the water, and they don't just swim straight off like most any other species does. They always list off to the side,
meaning like, at an angle.
Yeah, so instead of just driving like completely straight, they'll like swim at an angle. And then this paper came out, and Dr. Catherine McDonald, who I've been working with, she was like, yeah, for all these years, all of the people who like do scientific workups on hammerheads were saying that their release condition was like fair or poor, because with any other shark, them tilting on their side is like not what you want as a release behavior. And so people would like swim them off and like try to make them like swim straight instead of off to the side. So everyone was just like messing with hammerheads when they were just trying to help themselves when we were releasing them. And we just saw 3 great hammerheads last week. And one of the ones that we released listed at like a 45 degree angle when we released her. And I was like, this is crazy that like for all these years, everyone just thought that they were not releasing well and trying to straighten them. And the hammerheads in their heads are probably like, can you just get off of me? Like, I'm doing what's best for me.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing.
That's very cool to hear, because I've only ever worked with scalloped hammerheads. I've never done work with great hammerheads before. So that's actually very cool to hear that, like, when you release them, they will sometimes go at those banked angles.
Yeah, and I think later in the paper, you kind of mentioned that smaller species of hammerhead probably don't do that. And when we release bonnet heads, they don't list. They just, mm-hmm. they swim completely straight like any other shark that you'd want, which is like super interesting. And again, like they don't have the huge dorsal fin that hammerheads and scalloped hammerheads do. But it's like very interesting, especially to read it in a paper for the first time that I have, to like actually see that distinction in words, because I kind of like subconsciously knew that, but I'd never like said it out loud to anyone. And then I was reading it in the paper and I was like, oh yeah, that like bonnet head that I released 3 days ago just like swam off straight.
Yeah,
so let's kind of talk about that for a second, because Dr. Royer, you mentioned in your paper that you think that the dorsal fin needs to probably be larger than the pectoral fin length for them to do this behavior, and it helps them reduce drag. Do you think it's because that dorsal fin is longer that it helps them kind of lift up in the water column when they're on their side?
Yes, this is actually work that would have to be done, I think, in a follow-up study to validate that. So that's the hypothesis, but the strong evidence for that comes from the previous paper that was by Nick Payne et al., where they looked at great hammerheads, where they actually did a wind tunnel study where they built a model of a great hammerhead. And that's how they found that by putting that model in a wind tunnel and then rotating it at different banked angles and changing the pitch on it, they found that when that shark is pitched at a certain angle, rolled at a certain angle and at a certain pitch, it actually achieves greater lift than as if it was swimming upright, and also has greater hydrodynamic efficiency that way. So therein is like the strong, like the reason for why swimming at a rolled angle like that is important for these species. And having that larger dorsal fin is helpful because when that great hammerhead is pitched at an angle, and same with the scalloped hammerhead, the dorsal fin then becomes another lift surface, because when it's at an angle, it's almost like another wing. And so the effective lift span, so that's from the tip of the dorsal fin to the tip of the upright pectoral fin, is great. Like when you go across the body, is actually greater than from the tips of the two pectoral fins when the shark is upright. So by rolling onto its side, the effective lift surface for the whole shark across the body is increased. So that's why these sharks have greater lift when they swim at their side, and of greater hydrodynamic efficiency when doing so.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
So So that's, and going back to your point, when you said when you release these animals, by having, if that's like the point where they have the greatest amount of lift and possibly stability, after doing some like getting worked up after tagging, it's almost like that's probably like their default is to like, their bodies could even be like going to that state, whether they're intentionally doing it or if that's just like the way their body kind of naturally orients itself when swimming through the water, because that's the kind of the most like hydrodynamic efficient position.
Yeah. And you mentioned that the dorsal fin of juvenile hammerheads wasn't necessarily as proportionally large as in adults. Do you think that there's an advantage to that for younger scalloped hammerheads to not have such a tall dorsal fin in comparison to adult ones?
That's actually fascinating. This is actually another good lesson for younger researchers as well, too. So that we said that in the paper because we were repeating the same numbers that we got from the same reference that Nick Painadog got for when they plotted their dorsal fin to pectoral fin size ratio for their paper. And in the paper that they cited, it's way back from the 70s, where they measured a variety of shark fins from different species. They found like that initial paper way back found that like the recorded numbers showed that the dorsal fin was smaller than the pectoral fin for scalloped hammerheads. when I was able to find that paper and looked it back up, those measurements came from what looked like to be a majority of them were like juveniles or subadult sharks. And I don't know what the state of those sharks were, if these were left dead on a fishing boat for a long time, if they were dried up or in like some. So I found that very interesting too, because we have a lot of juvenile and subadult scalloped hammerheads back at our institute in captivity at the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. And so we actually had undergraduates do a little undergraduate research project. Emily Rose Gutgeld and Kelsey Maloney took measurements of the juvenile scalloped hammerheads that we had that were alive and well, and actually found that they actually had the same ratio as adults. So going back, so that's again, when we talk about an important part of science is
repeatability.
And we found this time, actually, from what we found here, is that these juveniles actually do have larger dorsal fins than their pectoral fins. So
was the previous study in the same part of the world? Was it also in Hawaii?
No, that one was back in Florida.
So is it possible that maybe they have slightly different morphology between Florida and Hawaii?
It is possible. So anyone who's listening to this in Florida, if you have access to juvenile scalloped hammerheads, take some fin measurements and
yeah,
see if that's valid. See if that initial paper from the 70s was a measurement error, or if indeed there is some type of difference in that.
Well, and then if in Florida, if their dorsal fin isn't as long proportionally to their pectoral fins, I wonder if they exhibit that rolling behavior in Florida.
That's a very good question.
My brain just like immediately went down this hole, like, oh my gosh, I have so many more questions.
It's definitely something that I think people should look at for a lot of these species, actually. It's like, even though we speculate that the smaller hammerhead species don't do this, it'll be still nice to validate that. And also, too, there's also the, no one's looked at the smooth hammerhead yet either, which is similar in size to the scalloped hammerhead and great hammerhead. And also there's the infamous Carolina hammerhead, which looks just like a scalloped hammerhead.
Genetics are different.
But it'd be fascinating to see if that behavior is exhibited as well.
I wonder, also winghead hammerheads? I mean, they're just weird, but I'm like curious because their heads are so much larger than the rest of their body.
I'm curious. I think I have like a very hard time like with the mental imagery of a winged head swimming on its side. So that one, I'm gonna say a probably definite no, but stranger things have been observed.
Yeah,
before,
I mean, they don't really look like they should morph like make sense anyway with like no, how they, large it, they look exactly. Like the head should just like drag them down it completely.
Yes.
And then this is just a thought I had. I wonder too, and this is, again, I'm just speculating at this point, but if they're side swimming, and then because their eyes are on either side of their head on that cephalofoil, do you think it could be advantageous for them to see above and below them at a different angle? Because I know they have like 360 vision, right, with their cephalofoil head?
Yes, that's a very good question. That what's so fascinating about this behavior, it ties into so many of the other interesting aspects of scalloped hammerheads or just large hammerheads in general. And that having their eyes apart like that, there was that study that looked at the effective field of view for hammerheads and found that they have better binocular vision or better crossover between their right and left eye compared to other species of shark, and that they have a very wide effective view of range. So orienting yourself at that kind of angle only about allows you to see both above you and below you as well too. So
it might be a survival instinct, I wonder too.
Mm-hmm. But it's so cool. What's also fascinating too is that for the longest time, people are wondered or hypothesized that the shape of that head, if that acted as a wing. Because if you look at the side of it, it almost looks like it's tapered like an aircraft wing. Mm. But there was that study that came out just recently that looked at the hydrodynamics of it, and they found that the head does not generate lift when it is doing level swimming. In fact, if anything, it actually produces a lot of drag for the shark to swim through. However, when it doesn't take much of a pitch angle in the head for it to have some rapid force effects on the shark in order to do tight turns. So Well, going back to the wings, to the head sizes and the fin sizes of these animals. What I loved the most about this study was that something that I find so fascinating about sharks, and I think a lot of people like about sharks, is that they remind people of airplanes.
Yeah.
In that, compared to other fish, because sharks have their rigid fins, they're almost just like the control surfaces of an aircraft, just how an airplane has its ailerons, its rudder, and their elevators. Sharks have their pectoral fins and dorsal fins and caudal fins to control their orientation. And they have their pectoral fins as to act as lifter and rigging surface, just like the wings of an aircraft. It's fascinating to look at all the different morphologies that sharks come in that if you're trying to design a shark is almost like the same as designing an aircraft, where depending on like what its role or what its purpose is reflected in their morphology.
Yeah.
And so with scalloped hammerheads, what's another thing that's super fascinating about them, you can see this in the accelerometer data, is that they are also a highly maneuverable shark.
Yeah.
So something that I got to see firsthand is that we had scalloped hammerheads and sandbar sharks in captivity outside of our lab at the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. They were similar body length sizes, but when we throw food into the water, if a sandbar shark overshot the food, it would have to just kind of this like wide arcing turn to get back to it, whereas the hammerhead could almost turn on a dime without banking its body, just kind of quickly swivel, almost touch its head back to its tail in a very tight maneuver, tight maneuvering. And there's another paper that was done by Steve Kajura back in the day, where he actually compared the maneuverability between hammerheads and sandbar sharks and just found how highly maneuverable scalloped hammerheads are.
Yeah, those are flexible sharks.
Yeah. What's fascinating is that, so I was wondering why is it important to have this side swimming behavior? There's a trade off between maneuverability and stability.
Yeah.
In fish, it's kind of like how there's a trade off in maneuverability and stability in aircraft. And so that the more stable you are, the harder it is to be maneuverable, and vice versa. What's fascinating about with scalloped hammerheads is that when they're in their upright position, they are a highly maneuverable shark. However, that probably creates more effort for them to keep themselves stable, to keep themselves upright. However, when they transition and roll on their swim on their side and swim in more of a straight line pattern, they are possibly more stable that way. And they're thus more efficient swimming through the water in that orientation. So kind of like how you were saying earlier, when you're releasing the great hammerheads, going into that kind of like that stability mode is, like I said, like probably most ideal for them after coming off of something such as like being worked up after tagging.
Right. Yeah. It saves them energy. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting that you mentioned in the paper was about how their behavior changed from day to night. And so in the paper you discussed, at night, they were doing like 82% side swimming. They might be traveling more at night. And then during the day, they're not on their side as much, but you think there might be more social behavior. So I wondered if you could kind of touch on that. Like, what kind of social interactions do scalloped hammerheads engage in? Why would that stop them from side swimming during those times?
That's a really good question. Some of the questions we actually don't know the answers to and require further study on, but some of that comes from previous studies that were done by Pete Flimley, where he was observing hammerheads off the Galapagos and in the Gulf of California as well, where he noticed where hammerheads would kind of form aggregations during the daytime and then disperse at night, either individually or in small groups. And so from what I could see on the video footage that I got from my hammerhead, was that it was only the video was only recording during the daytime, so I don't know what its social life was like at night. But during the daytime, I could see the shark swimming with join up with two other compsognathids as well, two other adult scalloped hammerheads join in with it. And also something that I'm going to do in a future paper is look at the magnetometer data, the compass heading data. And from what I'm seeing right now is that they're doing a lot more circle swimming, where they just kind of like go to, they just kind of hold a spot and just kind of like swim in these like wide circles, kind of holding their position. They do that a lot during the daytime, and I would not see that at all during the nighttime. So that's more whether it's some type of way of just socializing, or if it's some type of like resting behavior, kind of like how spinner dolphins will come into shallow areas during the daytime and just kind of turn half their brain off and swim in these circles with its other spinner dolphin friends, whether scout tamarins are exhibiting some type of social interaction like that too, while they're resting but holding like a, like kind of like a tighter geographic area.
Oh, that'd be so cool.
And then when nighttime comes, it's time for them to head offshore, either move the long distances that they want to for either migration or to move to different islands, or to move to their foraging grounds that are further offshore. Because when they do, I don't want to get too much into the deep dive part, but when they do these, their deep diving activity, they suspend that rolling behavior during the actual dive. But when they come up during the surface interval, they will go back, they'll go back into that rolling behavior.
Oh, that's so interesting. Do you see scalped hammerheads aggregate specifically by sex, or were they with other males or other females?
That's hard to say. Like we've seen the people on the Big Island have seen those female only aggregations. From what we can tell, those are female only aggregations off the Big Island of Hawaii during the winter months. Those aggregations go for a long depth as well too. So there could be males deeper, but we don't know. As far as we can tell, we've only seen females. In my video footage that I've seen from the camera on my shark, there were only males with it. But however, from other studies where they've attached cameras onto other sharks around Hawaii, they've seen mixed sex aggregations where there's males and females. So the short story to that is scalloped hammerheads have very complex social behaviors. Like even their mating is, which has been documented, is fascinating, where the females kind of show themselves off in the middle of in the center of an aggregation. The males trying to select for the best male to prime themselves up for the best selection for the males, which usually don't see that much in sharks. So that's all we really know. Whether they stay segregated or if they are segregated indeed, or they are segregated, how long they actually stay segregated from each other.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of social complexities that are yet to be studied with this species.
Oh, that's so cool. Mm-hmm. Man, I just have so many other things that I feel like we could have a whole other episode just on the questions. Yes. I feel like
definitely.
Yes. There's a lot of questions for this species.
It's so cool.
And if you're familiar with the work from Kara Yopak, who has done a lot of work on shark brains, you'll see that hammerheads have the largest and most complex brain.
Yes.
Comparison to other sharks, and usually with that comes more, and usually with a more complex brain comes more complex social behaviors as well.
I think that's so cool that their brain is like somewhat more proportionally correct to their body size in comparison to most other sharks, where you like do a dissection and their brain is like this large, even though their body's really big.
Yeah, that's so true. Is there anything else that we didn't touch on already, Dr. Royer, about this paper that we should talk about before we get to our favorite part of the podcast, which is field stories?
Let's see. I think we touched on all the key parts. I did enjoy talking the similarities between sharks and airplanes.
Yeah.
I think that stems from my childhood. It was like when I first got my teeth in, first things I would eat would be those General Mills shark fruit snacks and the Thunderjet fruit snacks. And if my parents were nice enough to send in the proof of purchases, where I was able to get a Mega Mouth toy with a glow in the dark mouth in the mail for
that's
that.
Fun.
So that's amazing. That's one of the... It was instilled in your childhood.
They say you are what you eat. So, and I ate shark gummies and airplane gummies. So
here we are.
Here we are today. Yes.
Fantastic.
Yes.
So We would love to hear a field story from you. It does not have to be from this paper, but something that you think is funny or inspiring or just like one of your overall favorite field stories, if you have any sort of internal mental ranking of them.
I tried to come up with just one in preparation for this, but there's so many, it's hard to choose.
We'll take more than one. Yes.
But some of my favorite parts, actually, like this wasn't like technically this technically wasn't in the field. I was just, so our institute, the Hawaiian Institute of Marine Biology, is on its own island inside Kaneohe Bay on Mokuloi or Coconut Island. During my off time, I'd like to go swim around the island because I like to swim and there's a beautiful reef that circles around the island. And during the summer months when I do laps around the island, sometimes I would see scalloped hammerheads swim by, just swimming around the island, just
hanging
the same as me. And it catches you off guard too, because the water clarity in the bay isn't fantastic. It's a bit murky and green. So sometimes as you turn to breathe, there would be a scalloped hammerhead right there. So it's very cool to just casually interact with your study species in the wild like that.
Yeah.
But I would say one of my favorite field stories, besides the ones I've already told of going door to door looking for these tags or going into high seas, getting these things and being successful with getting them back, that's such a euphoric feeling. Especially when earlier in the day you think you've lost it for good.
I know, I was gonna say your field work is, like we talked about already, is a field story, yes, in itself.
Yes. but when we were when I was saying earlier how we did a similar study like this on six-gilled sharks, there was a day where we went off to go. So we catch these things at 900 feet of water. We bring them to the surface, put this tag on them, and try to get them back down as quickly as possible to keep the shark in good condition. And these were adult six-gilled sharks, so they are anywhere from like 13 to 14 feet long, and they're just, they're essentially like if Jabba the Hutt was a shark. There's these big lofty bean bag
I feel like
things with rough skin and green eyes, but
jeez,
they
that's not a compliment.
They are so fascinating to see in person, that just how prehistoric they are. But when we went onto a field one day, we were tagging them, I had my then girlfriend, now wife, who was with us. I brought her in the field that day to help us out, and we hooked up a absolute monster of a female six-gilled shark. And even though these things are sluggish, they are just so heavy, so they have a lot of power in their slow movement. But when they come up to the surface and start thrashing around, that's just a lot of weight and a lot of momentum that they take with them. And so while I was trying to get the shark, the rope under the pectoral fins to get it up to the boat, my wife was trying to get a rope around the tail to secure it to the stern. And this thing just launches its tail up in the air and back down. And my wife's holding the rope and it almost like jerks. And I was thinking, oh my gosh, I just took my girlfriend onto the field and I almost break her arm. But luckily that didn't happen. She was okay.
We get
the shark secured. And again, another lesson coming up here at how different skills can be helpful in your scientific career. We were trying to get this tag package out on a shark, but the release band on it broke. So we felt like, oh, we're gonna have to scrub it off for that day. But my girlfriend was able to use her skills as in making jewelry to actually get this band back together and get it attached onto the shark so that we could get this tag package out on this animal and let it go. Because catching these things takes a lot of effort and you need the right conditions to do it. So if you don't do it then, you might have to wait 3 months to try again.
Shout out to your wife for saving the day.
And then, it doesn't end there too, because when we released that shark, we hope for it to like shoot back down to the bottom, but this one was a little disoriented. So, and these sharks are positively buoyant, which is unusual for sharks. Most sharks are negatively buoyant. So this thing was kind of, when we released it, it was kind of struggling at the surface for a little bit. So I had to grab my fins, jump in the water and try to get on top of it and push it down. It's a big shark and very buoyant. So I was basically just doing push-ups on the thing. It wasn't getting anywhere. It wasn't until I'd like grab onto the pin and hoist it upwards and then get it to swim downwards. So after that point, we eventually came up with a drop shot system to send these sharks back to depth rather than relying on trying to
swim it down
rather than try to take a giant, I think the size of a car, and swim it down to the bottom.
Yeah, no kidding. What a day for your wife to be out there.
Yeah.
Like, see, yeah. Field work. It's like, yep, this is what I do. Welcome.
Yeah. And she got like a day that you actually caught something. Like, I've gotten days like not catching anything, which like wasn't for lack of effort. It was just that nobody wanted to take the bait.
Oh yes, there's and for all those days where you're successful in getting tags out, there's all the days that come before that.
Nothing.
Strike out and
yep.
It's you think like, you know, or how much chum or bait you use. If yeah. There's nothing there. There's nothing there.
So much unit per effort per unit effort.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. It's a lot. Well, thank you very much. That was a great field story. I am sure that she had a fantastic day and now thinks that your days are like sharks all the time, constantly.
Right. And Dr. Royer, for our listeners, where can they follow your work? Are you on Twitter or anything?
I don't have any personal, I've got a personal photography account where I talk about my research, and because I also take photos of my research and research that I support as well. So that's on a Shark Mark Photography. That's a website. It admittedly needs to be updated. That will soon follow. But also there's an Instagram as well, Shark Mark Photography.
Awesome.
There's also, but there's work that I've been affiliated with on a lot of pelagic shark conservation work that we've been done, that's been done in Hawaii. That's headed by Dr. Melanie Hutchinson, who works for both NOAA and University of Hawaii. And that one, and so some of my research is linked in there. If you go to sharktagger.org.
Awesome.
Yep, and that's also the same as the handle Sharktagger Hawaii. So that's. I'm not sure if this rolling behavior has been mentioned. I think it has been mentioned in there, but that one, there's a lot more other conservation work for pelagic sharks that you can read up in there as well too.
Great. All right. Well, go make sure to follow him at those places. And Dr. Royer, thank you so much again for being here. I had so much fun getting to know this species more, and this rolling behavior is so interesting. I'm definitely going to be looking for that in the literature more from now on.
Thank you. And thank you both for having me. It was a lot of fun to be here, and I always love to like get any moment I can to talk about scalloped hammerheads, because for every facet about them, they're just one of the most fascinating shark species, and just what they're capable of and what they do is really extraordinary.
I absolutely agree. All right, well, thank you so much, Sharkies, for being here with Dr. Royer this week, and until next time,
swim you later. Hey Sharkies, if you've been enjoying Sharkpedia like we hope you have been, you can check out our Patreon, which is in the link tree in our bio on both Twitter and Instagram. And also, don't forget to rate and subscribe so that other people can find our podcast and hopefully hop on the train of loving sharks.
This episode was edited by Kayla Shue.